Voices and Events. The National Broadcasting Company brings you Voices and Events, the living dramatic record of history this week, compiled by the NBC News and Special Events Department. You'll hear The Voice of America versus Radio Moscow, General Spots, Herbert Hoover, the 5% Witnesses, the voice of John Barrymore, these and many others. You'll hear the actual voices of the people who made the news as they made it. Now, here's your editor for Voices and Events, James Fleming.
At this hour, the people of Germany are deciding their future. Since early morning, they've been going to the polls in the Western zones, the first free election since before Hitler. Let's get the story up to the moment by calling on NBC's correspondent in Germany, Ed Hocker in Frankfurt. Ed, how have you been impressed by today's voting?
Well, Jim, getting around to the polling places today, I've been much more impressed with the dignity of the people as they vote than I was with the politicians. They look like people who remember what a horrible mistake they made 16 years ago, and they don't want to repeat. I hope I'm right.
Well, that's good to hear, Ed. It wasn't a very lively campaign, was it?
No, the campaign was generally apathetic. It must be said, however, that whenever the nationalism of the German people was appealed to, they seemed to eat it up, as in this final rally in Frankfurt.
Diejenigen, die für die ungeheuren Verbrechen, die im Namen des deutschen Volkes von Deutschen gegenüber anderen Völkern begangen worden sind, die Verantwortung tragen, sollen diese Verantwortung auch in voller Stärke büßen.
All too often, it was the rabble-rousing spirit that got the big hand during the campaign. All too often, those of us covering the German elections heard an echo we didn't much care for, an echo of this.
Heil unser Führer! Heil! 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 Heil!
Today, the German people, as they went to the polls in the West Zones, stand on the road back. They voted as free men and women. Whether they can hold on to that remains to be seen.
Angry words heard in Washington this week as congressional investigators began looking into the B-36 bomber program.
Republican Representative James Van Zandt started it all, repeating, he said, what were ugly rumors about politics in the bomber purchasing program. Van Zandt, a Naval Reserve officer, was accused in turn of sniping at the B-36 from the Navy point of view. Up to the Capitol went the highest Air Force officials to tell their side. When it came time for Air Chief of Staff Hoyt Vandenberg, Congress heard some unusually frank words from the general. He took off the gloves like this.
First, there is only one major military threat to the security of the United States and to the peace of the world. It is pointless to talk in riddles. This threat comes from the Soviet Union. Second, in dealing with the Soviet Union, the normal international processes of negotiation, agreement, and adherence to the pledged word have not succeeded in creating world stability. Third, under current realities of world economic and military power, the current aggressive thrust of the Soviet Union can be contained only by the active participation of the United States with the other nations of the Western world. The first priority of the joint defense is our ability to deliver the atomic bomb. The B-36, or the intercontinental bomber type, is only one part of strategic air power. And strategic air power is only one part of the Air Force as a whole.
For an outside view on the B-36 hearings, Voices and Events called on retired General Carl Spatz, wartime chief of the Strategic Air Forces, and now an editor of Newsweek magazine. What's the view of General Spatz on the investigation so far?
From testimony presented to the Armed Services Committee by the Air Force so far, there can be no question about the integrity of the high military and civilian officials in the military establishment insofar as the procurement of B-36s is concerned. Furthermore, it should have been driven home that the B-36 is the only intercontinental bomber in existence, and with the atomic bomb absolutely essential for the security of the United States and the peace of the world today. It remains to be determined who is responsible for the serious charges being circulated about strategic bombing, of which the B-36 is an incidental but vital part, and what is the motive behind the efforts of these sources to disparage a service vital to the security of our country.
A realignment of the military this week, and a famous general took on a new job.
Dwight Eisenhower had been acting as chairman for the chiefs of staff, but now a permanent chairman was needed to supervise strategic planning and see to it that Army, Navy, and Air Force worked together in harmony. Choice for the job, General Omar Bradley. Our NBC microphone caught the scene as General Bradley was given his assignment by Defense Secretary Johnson.
General, I've admired you from afar for a long time. I'm one of those who agreed with the boys in the ranks that you were the GI's general.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I feel greatly honored in having been appointed to this position as the first chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Among other developments in the Cold War this week was a new twist to the battle of words and propaganda.
Day in, day out, around the clock, the Voice of America beams its story by shortwave to the Soviet Union. 110 transmitters and relay stations to penetrate the curtain of silence imposed by Moscow. But this week, Cold War tacticians noted with interest that the Kremlin was so intent on blanketing the Voice of America with interference that 250 Russian transmitters were assigned the job of drowning out the programs with noise and static. Listen now to an actual instance of how this works. First, a typical Voice of America program beamed to Russia.
Война, которую Коминформ объявил год тому назад коммунистическому руководству Югославии, постепенно распространяется из политической и экономической областей.
Now, hear how monitors in Moscow picked up this very same program. The interference, the jamming of the broadcast is what diplomats mean when they speak of the Iron Curtain. But now, listen to the other side in this battle of propaganda. Here in the NBC newsroom are shortwave monitors tuned to Radio Moscow.
This is Radio Moscow, and here's the news. New York. In compliance with the resolution recently adopted by the United Nations Atomic Energy Commission, the six permanent members of the...
No jamming on this side. Any night, anyone with a shortwave receiver can tune in to 11,960 kilocycles and hear the Soviet radio. Moscow's story coming in for all who care to hear. It leads strategists to ask of this war of ideologies, who's afraid?
This week there came to our shores the chief executive of a very new republic.
1 week after the State Department's white paper wrote off the nationalist government of China as a corrupt failure, the Far East was still the center of attention for many in our government. There was talk of a Pacific Pact from President Carino of the Philippines. He arrived in the United States to say,
I have come to your country in furtherance of mutual understanding between your country and mine for the preservation not only of freedom and prosperity, but also of the peace of the world in our part of the globe.
The State Department white paper on China aroused additional comment. This week, the Chinese ambassador spoke up. The white paper, he said, represented only the American side. In effect, give us another chance, asked China. Hear it from Ambassador Wellington Koo.
China is willing to learn from her past experience and try to do her job better and more effectively in the future. A free China is indispensable to a free Asia, and a free Asia is vital to the existence of a free world.
Polio struck in many more homes across the nation this week, perhaps 11,000 cases in all of this baffling disease. Health authorities call it a moderate epidemic and say the end is not yet in sight.
You're listening to the sound of an iron lung, not a dreaded device of last resort, but a weapon of science in its battle against poliomyelitis, infantile paralysis. Hospitals and doctors this year are moving still closer to inevitable triumph over polio. In Chicago, NBC reporter Jim Hurlbut talks with a boy stricken by bulbar polio, the most serious form of the disease, and the doctor who brought him back to health.
I'd like to have you meet a young fellow who's just recovered from bulbar polio, supposedly the most virulent type of that dread disease. His name is Sam Nico Jr. He's right here beside me, and I think he looks pretty good. How do you feel, Sam?
I feel pretty good now.
Well, you look swell. Sam, when you first felt polio coming on, what did it feel like?
It felt like I had a headache and I had a fever, and I couldn't swallow real good.
And then you went to the hospital where you were under the care of Dr. Edward Pizik, the director of the Cook County Board of Health. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is Dr. Pizik who's here with us. And, Doctor, I'd like to have you tell us something about Sam's treatment in the hospital.
Sam was one of our most interesting as well as serious patients. When he first came into the hospital, he couldn't swallow or he couldn't talk. He had a distinctly nasal voice, and he had quite a bit of weakness. 24 hours after his admittance, after he was fed by vein, he couldn't swallow, couldn't eat anything, he was placed in the respirator, the iron lung, where he remained for 4.5 days. After that, he was fed by a nasal tube, a tube which leads from the nose down into the stomach to get his nutrition. And after that happened, why, he began to eat all over again like a newborn baby with cereal and mashed potatoes and applesauce.
Well, it was just 3 weeks ago that Sam went to the hospital, and just last Monday he was released and went home.
That's right.
And now he's getting around pretty well.
He's getting along swell.
Of no little importance in combating polio is the cooperation of the public. Ignorance and fear of the disease are a primary problem for such organizations as the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis. We asked the foundation's medical director, Dr. Kenneth Landauer, just what are the facts in the polio story?
One of the toughest things to fight in connection with every polio epidemic is the fear and occasionally the panic that accompany it. In its way, fear can do as much damage as the disease itself. And that fear is based largely on misconceptions about polio. I'd like to offer some reassuring facts. First, let's consider the fear parents have that their children may get polio. Actually, the risk of getting polio is very low. Even in epidemics, it strikes only a very small percentage of people. Second, and all parents should find reassurance in this, with early diagnosis and early modern medical care, 3 out of every 4 make good recoveries. The chances are excellent, therefore, that your child will not get polio, and if he does, the chances that he will make a good recovery are all in your favor. Remember, the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis is making the best possible facilities, equipment, and care available to you if you should need it. Remember also that the National Foundation will pay for whatever part of the cost of this care which the patient's family is unable to afford.
People in the news. And this week it was the American people writing a happy ending to a love story.
Charles Eller of Fresno, California is an ex-GI. Lee Beckman is a pretty German girl. They'd met in Europe, planned to marry. But jobs were scarce in Fresno when Charles Eller came home. There was no money to pay Lee's passage. In desperation, both offered to sell their eyes so they could be together. Generous Fresno citizens would have none of that. They and many others chipped in, and this week Charles Eller and Lee Beckman were married in Fresno. The new bride was asked, "What do you think of the American people?"
Oh, my heart is so full that all I can say is thank you. It's been just like a dream.
What are your plans for the future?
I'd like to rest for a few days after the wedding and then get to work. I'm not worried about the future now.
And me, I don't care about the future, just as long as I can be with my child.
The weather was the number one problem here in the East this week as we sweltered in another heat wave. And in England, a young American girl also worried over the weather.
Shirley Mae France was all set, ready to go on her attempt to swim the English Channel. Her training period was finished, and now if only those choppy channel waters would subside, well, here's how she told it in an interview with the BBC.
She's all ready to go. She reckons she's trained to the minute. So, Shirley, when is it going to be?
I don't know. It all depends on the weather and the tide. The weather, since I've been here, is very dull. It's been really terrible. But before I came, they say the weather was perfect. So the way I feel, I brought the weather with me.
What plans have you got for the for the crossing itself. How do you plan to work it?
Well, I'm swimming from Grenay to any side on the English coast. It doesn't make any difference where I land, just so I finish. And it's a stretch of 35 miles, so I'll have to swim. And I intend to do it in about 13 hours.
You are listening to Voices and Events, the actual voices of the people who made the news this week as they made it. A living record of history compiled by the NBC News and Special Events Department. Now, from the NBC Newsroom in New York, here again is James Fleming.
You take a bottle of brandy, a book of paper matches, a racetrack, mix together and season with some of Washington's biggest names, and store it in a deep freeze unit. Those were the ingredients of a 5% story this week, as the Senate Investigating Committee began looking into the men who sell their influence in high places for a fee. Senator Clyde Huey of North Carolina is the chairman of the committee, and at the outset of the hearings, this is what he said.
The purpose of this hearing is to consider the broad question of what safeguards Congress can take to prevent or minimize improper influences.
First to take the stand was the man who started it all by telling the New York Herald Tribune of his experience with the 5%er. Paul Grindle, a New England businessman, tells the senators what he was told by a man named James V. Hunt.
He said that General Vaughn, whom he identified as being President Truman's military aide, was one of his closest friends, and he said that he could go and did go to the White House at any time. And he said that I have only one thing to sell, and that is influence.
Yes, the military seemed very much involved in this story of influence in Washington. Two generals were suspended from their high posts, and the senators heard how one of them wrote self-praising memos and moved in the same circles with General Harry Vaughan and the much-mentioned Mr. Hunt. The happenings on Capitol Hill brought Defense Secretary Louis Johnson on the run to tell Committee Chairman Huey,
"We are in entire sympathy, Mr. Chairman, with your determination, as so admirably expressed in your statement of a moment ago, to get rid of these unscrupulous men who prey both on business and government by selling. Rather, I would call it peddling, influence. You can count on our wholehearted cooperation in the Department of Defense."
Then a question from a committee member, the lady senator, Margaret Chase Smith, who wants to know how a small businessman can get government contracts without the help of these 5%ers. She asked Secretary Johnson like this.
"Would you tell us how a small businessman, and I mean a small one, would come in here and find his way around without some guidance?"
"I can appreciate his trouble. There are 17 and a half miles of corridors, I'm told, in the Pentagon building. Now we're going to broadcast to the world that here's one office with competent, qualified, and I'll see to that, representatives of the three services sitting in there. He can go in there, and he's got to get a kindly reception if he's a bona fide small businessman."
Next to the Senate witness stand came housing expediter Ty Woods. Did he know James V. Hunt? "Yes, indeed," said Woods. "Why, there was even a nickname for Hunt. He seemed to be always getting fat government jobs for friends, so..."
"In social gatherings, we called him the Kingmaker."
Ty Woods next tells how he was summoned to the White House by Vaughn to talk about a construction permit for the Tanforan racetrack.
"The first conversation that I had with General Vaughn was at his request to come over and talk to him about this case at the White House. At that time, he discussed it with me, and to the best of my recollection, he said, I want to make sure that there's no prejudice in your office simply because this is a racetrack."
6 days later, Tanforan Racetrack got a construction permit. And, oh yes, those deep freeze units. The senators were working on that at week's end. Who got them, from whom, what for? The story had it that General Vaughn, Chief Justice Vinson, Mrs. Harry Truman, and George V. Allen all received the mysterious deep freeze units. We reached former White House intimate George Allen here in New York. George, did you ever get a deep freezer?
"I certainly never got one, but I wish I had one now. In the middle of this New York heat wave, I'd climb right into it."
Yes, it was so hot this week, many a citizen envied those who could go without clothes. and a couple of ladies who make a profession of just that figured in the news.
In Canada, striptease dancer Gypsy Rose Lee was bedded down with a cold after being caught in a chilling draft. In Illinois, the state fair director said nothing doing to Sally Rand when she arrived, fans and all. It seemed time to us to look into the business of the striptease and that vanishing American institution, the burlesque show. The lore of burlesque will be preserved for posterity. A college professor announced that he's writing a treatise on the subject. We asked him to drop around to the NBC newsroom for a chat with reporter George Hicks. Let's listen in on their scholarly discussion.
I would like to bring to you Professor Stuyvesant Van Veen, Associate Professor of Art at the City College of New York. Professor Van Veen is now writing a book on burlesque. He says he studied it for 14 years. You say burlesque is not just lowbrow, Professor Van Veen.
I've found in my observation that burlesque has a universal appeal.
Well, you personally are well acquainted with the strip, the grind, the bumps, and the blackout.
I am indeed. As a matter of fact, I think it's one of the attractive phases of burlesque, though not the only phase.
Have you said the striptease in burlesque can almost be called a native dance? Would you mind explaining that, Professor Van Veen?
Well, there have been variations on the theme of the removal of garments in the process of dancing, but the strip has a certain merry brashness about it, which I feel is rather typical of the entire spirit of the American culture.
Veteran police officers in Baltimore this week puzzled over a murder case as weird as anything in drugstore thrillers.
The voodoo murder case, they called it. A spirit medium named Emma Kefalis was found strangled to death in her Baltimore apartment. Love potions, hex signs, all cluttered the tiny room. As homicide detectives tried to unravel the bizarre clues, other spirit mediums in Baltimore volunteered their help to police, offered to call on the netherworld to learn who killed Emma Kefalis. Reporter Tom White of station WBAL took his microphone into the seance of spiritualist Barbara Burns and listened.
There seems to be a lot of money involved in this murder, although the money does not seem to be in the house. It seems as if there are two people involved, and it also seems as if the suspects either come from Middle River or Essex. In that direction, it seems as if the spirit forces show me that they come from out of the city of Baltimore. I also get the impression that Mrs. Kefalis not only let the people in, but knew them and had worked with them and seen them many times before.
Hearing this, one Baltimore cop commented, "I seem to see fingerprints and other more tangible clues." Well, the manhunt in the voodoo murder case is still on.
Herbert Clark Hoover is our only living ex-president. But this generation of statesmen preferred another title for the one-time chief executive, President Emeritus of the United States.
In his role of President Emeritus, Herbert Hoover earned the acclaim of leaders of both political parties for his efforts to reorganize the government and reduce the burden of taxation. This week, on the occasion of his 75th birthday, ex-President Hoover spoke again on the subject of spending.
We must wish to maintain a dynamic and progressive people. No nation can remain static and survive, but dynamic progress is not made with dynamite. And that dynamite today is the geometrical increase in the spending of our governments, both federal, state, municipal, and county. And along this road of spending, the government either takes over, which is socialism, or dictates institutional and economic life, which is fascism.
There were many to disclaim Hoover's views on government spending, and in fact they did. But the nation he served and still serves as President Emeritus could note these words.
So my word to you, my fellow citizens, on this 75th birthday is this. The Founding Fathers dedicated the structure of our government to secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves and for posterity. We of this generation inherited this precious blessing. Yet as spendthrifts, We're on our way to rob posterity of its inheritance.
After the excitement of his birthday celebration, Mr. Hoover was stricken with a gallbladder attack. But today, the good news is that the former chief executive is feeling fine and continuing his journey to New York.
Coming up tomorrow, a birthday for a grand and gracious lady of the American theater.
Ethel Barrymore will be 70 years old on Monday, rounding out half a century of performing on the stage and screen. The tributes will be many, but when she was quoted this week as saying, "Not a day passes without her thinking of her brother John," voices and events found on the record of history, John Barrymore's tribute to his sister Ethel. Listen now to the voice of John Barrymore.
She's a very, very splendid person. And all through both our lives has been just like a rock of Gibraltar. And it's a wonderful thing having in one's immediate family someone of such gaiety, charm, and splendor that one has only to think of her to be invested with the God-given quality of humility. My first recollection of my sister as an actress was in the deathless performance of Camille, which she, my brother Lionel, and myself produced and enacted before an enraptured audience in a barn in North Long Branch, New Jersey. I was 10 years old, Ethel was 12, and Lionel 14. Ethel was Camille, Lionel was Armand Duval, the leading man, and I was the Comte de Varville, the villain. It was my first experience as a menace, and I gave it all I had, including a large black mustache made of corn silk and pasted on with LePage's glue. All went well until the scene in the gambling den in which Ethel did a saraband, or gypsy dance, with a tambourine which came magically from heaven knows where. The effect on the audience was stupendous. Lionel and I, to whom this innovation was totally unexpected, stood there like two galvanized tailor's dummies till a slightly older boy named Arthur Byron saved the situation by sweeping up to her and saying the amazing line, which he evidently had made up himself on the spur of the moment, "Come, entice me further, pretty one, over a libation in the conservatory." And the curtain descended before an enraptured, in fact, a convulsed audience. Ethel gave me my first break in the theater. She put me on the stage for the first time professionally in a play called Captain Jinx. I next played with her in a drama called Sunday, in which she spoke the now famous line, "That's all there is. There isn't any more."
This has been Voices and Events, the living record of history this week, compiled by the NBC News and Special Events Department, the voices of the people who made the news as they made it. Your editor, James Fleming. This is Robert Warren speaking and inviting you to listen again next week for Voices and Events.
What are little girls made of? Sugar and spice? Well, perhaps some of them are, but not Ethel Merman. No, sir, Ethel's wild and brassy and just as sassy on her own new Ethel Merman show, the latest addition to NBC's Sunday night roster of hit shows. She's all yours on the new Ethel Merman show tonight on NBC. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.